This is Everything is Workable, a podcast where we examine how every experience, every situation, every moment is an opportunity to work with our mind. I'm your host, Caitlin Hatch, creative polymath and dedicated consumer of wisdom. In this season, I'm talking to other people about their approach to life and practice. Today's episode is an interview with Chris Seeley, a former student of political science and good friend of mine. He talks about taking the time to think deep thoughts and how doing so helps us to better understand our place in the world and how we can be of benefit. We discuss how to bring your attention to implicit biases and the importance of questioning how we think, act, and speak. A content notification: this episode has explicit language used in the context of discussing race, as well as Luke Cage spoilers. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Your support in getting this in front of an even wider audience is hugely appreciated. You can also support the show by leaving me a tip through my website, CaitlinSCHatch.com. And now, on with the show.
How are things going?
Things are actually going pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How is things on the job front?
Oh, I'm not even looking.
Oh, that's good. Does that help?
Not looking?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. All the disappointment that comes from either finding jobs I want but can't have,
yeah,
or jobs that I can have but don't want is just kind of pushed aside by not looking for a job at all.
You know, that I do find that that can be such a good practice. Yesterday, actually, because I flew back from Seattle yesterday, and there was lots of things going on, altitude change being one of them, depression of departing from my wife, which always sucks. And then I kept on pushing myself to try to do things yesterday, and then I just felt worse, and I was like, this is stupid. I'm just going to Netflix. And I felt a lot better.
Yeah, sometimes the best thing to do when doing things is getting you down is to just do nothing.
Just go with the demotivation, or just go with the, actually, you know what? The more I try to do this thing, it makes me feel worse. So I'll just take a break.
Yeah, relaxation is very important.
It is. I think for me, the difficulty I have is because it skirts the fine line of laziness. I've got this whole thing where I'm like, oh, precious human birth, which is a Buddhist thing. And it's like, don't waste the opportunity that you have. But then at the same time, gentleness is important.
Yeah. It's also pretty recent in history that people like us would have the opportunity to do nothing.
What do you mean when you say people like us?
Well, you're a lady and I'm brown.
Yeah.
So up until pretty recently in history, neither of us would have had the opportunity to do nothing unless the person who owned us told us to do nothing.
Yes, this is true. Or actually, as a woman, depending on where you were born, you may have been obligated to do nothing.
True. True.
Which would also have sucked.
Yeah.
You know, when people say, oh, when would you have liked to have been alive? I'm like, well, in this embodiment, right now is the best time to be a woman, definitely, in history. And also where I live, living in Canada in particular, living in the UK for a while, in the States. Yeah, these are all places where there's still lots of problems, but it's better than it ever was.
Definitely. I think a lot of the time when people get upset with the state of the world and politics right now, it's because they're lacking the frame of reference to see where we've come from, even in the last 100 years. You know, in Alberta right now, people are very upset that the government does things that they don't like. And they talk about government as being, you know, thieves and fat cats that are stealing their money just to get rich, not realizing that even 100 years ago, actually even today in a lot of places in the world, people still pay taxes to their government and they get very little to nothing back for it.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting quite a bit back for the investment that we're putting in here in Canada.
You're talking about hindsight and using hindsight to appreciate where we are now. And I think also hindsight speaks a lot to foresight, where we're going to be going. So your background, sociology.
Well, political science.
Uh-huh.
So it's some sociology, some psychology, some communications, and a whole lot of history.
Okay. How do you find knowing where we've been helps you with where you are personally right now?
Well, specifically to tie it back into the doing nothing,
uh-huh,
I spend a lot of time thinking, because I can. I also struggle with feeling like that's being lazy, or that there's other things that I should be doing with my time. But through hindsight, I can look back to, you know, the Greek philosophers that I was studying, even philosophers all the way up through the Middle Ages. And the entire point of society for these people was so that those of us who have the ability to think deep thoughts would have the time and support that we needed to just sit and think about them. Your measure of success in life wasn't how much money you had or how much property you had. It was how much time you had. So by looking at it through that lens, I look at everybody, you know, scurrying around right now, feeling like they need to fill every minute of their day doing something and being productive and not spending any time to sit and think. It almost seems like, you know, they're missing the point because they don't know where it is that we came from to get here.
It's quite a switch, really, when you think about what we appreciate and how often, I guess what it is we don't appreciate boredom enough. Because when we appreciate boredom, we daydream. And when we daydream, we speculate, we think, we consider, we contemplate. And those are really beneficial things.
Totally. The only time you can really settle your thoughts and allow things to come together is when you're not focusing them. Like a lot of people have incredible shower thoughts because that's a point in time when you're not thinking about thinking. You're just doing it because there's nothing else for your mind to do. I think that ties a lot into meditation or people who run or do yoga, things that occupy your body. So your mind can occupy itself, I guess, without necessarily having a reason or a goal before you start thinking.
Of course, it's also that noticing what's going on. I know from meditating for years now, how I've come to realize how often how I feel has something to do with a thought, which as a source of information, it can be questionable. And when I notice what my thoughts are, I can notice which ones are useful, although arguably within meditation, they do tell you, like, don't rank thoughts. It's not like some of them are extra special and others aren't. But there is I think it's a Zen saying. It's first thought, best thought, which is like, don't overthink, basically. Let things arise naturally and experience it in your mind, in your body, and see what that can tell you about a situation.
Definitely. I've certainly realized as well that there's times when I'm thinking, but I'm not doing it consciously. It's difficult to describe. It's like I get a feeling that there is something going on in my head. You know, something is coming together.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily sure of what the end product is going to be or what it's about. And then at some point in time, I have a random thought that seems totally useless and totally idle. But that's, you know, the missing link. The connection that was lacking between two other ideas. The biggest thing when I talk about thinking deep thoughts is seeing connections between things. There's nothing in this world that is isolated. And if we're only seeing everything around us and understanding everything around us in isolation, we're missing out on 90% of whatever is going on.
Oh, see, okay, that's an awesome point. This is something else that I've been speaking to a lot of people quite regularly about recently, where you get that statement from people where they say, well, but I'm just one person, so what can I do? When I hear that, I'm like, yeah, but that assumes that you're outside of everything. But you are one person within a collective, interdependent existence. Like, you're not separate from it. So by doing your own deep thinking, by cultivating any kind of self-awareness, you are making a difference because you're part of it. You're not outside of it.
Yeah. And so many people don't realize that they are part of a thing. Like, my general life philosophy is that there is this monolithic thing called life with a capital L.
Yeah.
And that encompasses everything that is alive. And I am one piece of life. I'm one aspect of it. I don't even believe that within my own body, I am a life. I'm more of an ecosystem for several living things. For me, it's impossible not to see myself as connected to everything else. But a lot of people seem to believe that human beings are somehow a special form of life that exists separate from all the other things that are alive. And that's definitely a harmful thought, not just for people in and of themselves, but for all the rest of us too.
How did you come to this kind of realization? Like, what was your experience in your life that brought you to an understanding of like, wow, actually what I do matters and I am part of everything?
Well, the first thing was actually in a biology class. We were talking about the different kinds of organisms, you know, bacteria, viruses that live inside the human body.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of sheer number of cells, there's more cells inside your body that are not human than are human. And every advanced living creature, you know, everything we call complex life is like that. It's not just life in and of itself. It's also an ecosystem for other forms of life. And that made me realize that, you know, I'm not one single thing. This body that I live in isn't just one thing. It's more like a forest.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of different things that live here. And yes, all the biggest things are trees, or in my case, all the biggest things are human. But there's many other things that live in there too. Just understanding that, I wasn't able to see any division between being a human being and being any other kind of animal or any other kind of life. You know, it was just all life is more or less the same.
From a Buddhist perspective, the understanding of this interconnectedness is taught as emptiness. Emptiness can be a problematic translation because people take emptiness to mean nothingness. But really, when you say that things are empty of something, what they're really saying within Buddhism is it's empty of an inherent existence. Mm-hmm. So coming back to what you're talking about, when you talk about the very scientific, and this is why I find Buddhism is really scientific, the very scientific realization of the ecosystem of just your body, even just awareness of the component parts of your body, if you were going to look at it like a very analytical meditation you can do, is to try and find the self, which is impossible to find because there's not a singularity. There's all the component parts. You can say, like, if you take away your arm, are you still you? If you take away your heart, are you still you? If you take away your mind, are you still you? Do you reside in just any single, like, what is you exactly kind of thing? And it becomes very ineffable very quickly. I can't really pin this down. But from my understanding and speaking to people and like listening to you, it's something you can understand it, but it's really hard to put words to it exactly.
Definitely. That's actually been the thought that's been occupying my mind for the last week or so.
Okay.
Is what part of me is actually me? Because I definitely, like I said, I understand that there's many things that live inside this body. And currently I'm dealing with anxiety and depression, which are physical manifestations, I guess, of neurochemicals being out of balance, yeah, and things like that. And I treat that as something that is wrong with my body, not something that is wrong with my mind. As far as I've managed to get to this conclusion of what I am in terms of living inside this body, is that I am just one of the many things that lives inside this body. And this body is one of the many forms of life that makes up this ecosystem that I call me. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, like brain injuries, mm-hmm, and things like that, because a lot of people believe that the self resides in the brain. That's where your consciousness takes place. But there are people who have, you know, suffered an inability to communicate with their body as a result of, you know, an accident or a disease. So their mind is still perfect, but their body is broken and they're still the same person. And then the opposite occurs where, you know, people suffer a traumatic brain injury and their body is fine, but what we would consider to be their consciousness seems to no longer be present.
Or it's completely different.
Or it's completely different. Yes.
Right. And then that brings up the wonderful question of personality.
Yes.
Which I find really hard to define.
Yeah.
Like, what is a personality? Because a lot of the time people talk about particular traits as being a personality. And there's, I think of it as a grand paradox of life, is the statement that people never change and people always change. And it's like that sort of, the one hand we have the belief of a leopard doesn't change its spots, and like we have something that's inherent in personality. But then on the other hand, we know we change. I'm not the same as I was when I was 12. Like, I'm obviously not the same as I was when I was born, but I'm not even the same as I was 6 months ago. So what does that say about personality and how we define it and where it is and who we are and how we think of ourselves? Like, are we our awareness, our consciousness, our personality, all those things in collaboration, which are always changing? So how could we ever possibly pin down a singular self?
Totally. Well, there are some elements of personality that can be attributed to particular things. So, for example, one aspect of personality is preferences. You know, things that we like and we don't like. And I was actually reading a study last week that talks about how the receptors and sensors and bacteria and stuff in your gut interacts with your brain. It's quite possible a lot of your preferences, say, for like, you know, different flavors or smells or things like that, are being determined by things that we don't consider to be us. You know, like the bacteria in your gut is another form of life that's doing its own thing in this ecosystem. But it might be telling you, hey, we really want pizza with anchovies. So that's kind of like an obscure example, but it's totally possible that a lot of the things that we do consider to be us are just an expression of some other thing in this ecosystem and not necessarily our consciousness directly. One other thing I'd been thinking about along those same lines was that as much as we believe our consciousness to be, you know, the deciding factor in how we act and what we do, which is how other people see our personality. Like, who we are isn't something you can really share with another person, but they can hear what you say and they can see what you do. And a lot of the things that we say and do aren't things that we consciously think about before we say and do them. One thing that's pretty relevant right now would be if somebody says or does racist things, we would say that they are a racist person. But we don't actually know what their reason was for saying or doing those things. So a lot of our external judgment of somebody's personality isn't actually based on who they are, but what they're saying and doing. And we know from looking at ourselves that many of the things that we say and do are almost subconscious. They're our default settings, if you will, and not conscious decisions that we're making every second of the day. So I think that makes it even more difficult to define who somebody is. So what I try to do when I'm thinking about that, I don't think about what my absolute essence is, you know, who I am. I just think about what it is that I say and what it is that I do, because that would be the best way of expressing whoever I am as a person or a consciousness, because it's incredibly confusing to try and pin down what either of those things are.
This is looking at implicit bias, which is an interesting one because it says a lot about our sense of self-determination and self-awareness and free will, right? Like, there's this idea, we get it in our head, I'm a good person because I'm a good person. I'm not sexist, I'm not racist, I'm not homophobic. So if I say or do something that someone else then points out to me as an action or as something that was said is racist or sexist or whatever, the gut reaction is not being interested in looking at that because of this idea of who we are, which is I am a good person and I couldn't possibly have those implicit biases. I did see a really brilliant tweet, I think it was, that was like, I don't believe that I can possibly be influenced by the society and cultural structure in which I was raised, quote, white people everywhere. And it's uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable thing to be confronted with your implicit bias and to be confronted with the idea of who you think you are in your head being challenged by what someone else has picked up from what you've said or what you've done.
Yeah. It's almost a threat to your identity.
So you're describing taking an approach of genuinely having, would you describe it as a sense of curiosity about what you say and what you do?
Definitely.
So not being unconscious in it.
Yeah. For the most part, before I speak, I try to think about what I'm going to say and how people are going to react. I do that as well with my actions. And a lot of that comes from being a not white person in Calgary growing up. I needed to think ahead about how people were going to react to what I was saying and how I was acting, because I knew that they would have an implicit bias that could potentially be harmful to me. So that's something I've always been very conscious of. I find that, you know, even when I'm out in public today, like if I'm walking through the park and someone is sitting on a bench reading, I'm going to look at that situation and decide whether or not this person would be uncomfortable if I said hi to them or if I should just keep walking by. I don't just do whatever I'm going to do. I think about it first. And then the second step, after I've thought about it and chosen my action, is to question why it is I choose to act that way. Am I choosing to say hi because I think, you know, it will make this person less afraid of people who look like me? Am I choosing to do it because I just want to say hi? And it's that second level of questioning, of examining why it is I made the choices that I made, that helps me to be better prepared to deal with other people's reactions.
This is a conversation that's happening definitely online a lot, but just generally, there's a lot more conversation about the experience of awareness based on different embodiments in the world and experience, right? So, and obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement, it's particularly prominent in talking about behavior. And this is something I talk about in terms of victim blaming versus personal responsibility. In defining each of them, I say victim blaming is when as a society or as an individual, we put the onus for what happened in a situation on a single person, where personal responsibility is we recognize that interconnectedness that we have with everything around us. There is this attitude of saying, well, if Black people didn't do this, they wouldn't get persecuted so much, right? Like they wouldn't experience that threat from the police in the States in particular, although it does happen in Canada, despite what people like to think. So there's things like, well, Black people shouldn't wear hoodies kind of deal. And for me, I go, okay, that's victim blaming, because we shouldn't have to police people's clothing for them to feel safe. That's weird. But the personal responsibility side of it is more what you're describing, where you're walking along and you're having an awareness of why you choose to do what you do in the context of your understanding of something that's much bigger than just you and that person sitting on a bench.
Yeah. The the whole Black Lives Matters thing is really complicated.
It is.
I think because in the United States right now, there's a lot of mingled identities. A lot of the problem, if we're going to talk about, you know, the implicit bias of police, that Black people are more violent and aggressive and therefore require a more aggressive response. And this is arising out of, you know, high violent crime levels in certain regions where predominantly Black people live. And so this is being viewed as an issue about race. When if you look at all the other socioeconomic factors, yeah, you know, poverty and lack of access to resources has more of an effect on the crime rates in those neighborhoods, and especially the violent crime rates, than skin color does. But instead of seeing it as a matter of there's poor people who are turning to crime because they don't have other opportunities, and we need to address the issue of getting poor people job training and meaningful jobs and wages that they can support families on. You know, like that's the direction we should be looking at it.
Yep.
But instead, we're looking at it from just the race angle. We're saying, you know, like Black people are being killed disproportionately. And yes, they are. And police are being racist against Black people. And yes, they are. But dealing with the race issue isn't going to solve that problem. The identity that we should be looking at in order to address the mistrust between police and the African American community is jobs, opportunities, poverty. Once we no longer have ghettoized neighborhoods where visible minorities live and there's high levels of crime with low opportunities and poor schools, that underlying justification, if you will, for being racist is no longer there. because there's no longer other socioeconomic factors that can be represented by this view of race.
There is often this mentality that there's going to be a single solution for what is an incredibly complex problem that's been created over years and years and years. I really have begun to appreciate how much class plays a part in all forms of discrimination. And that needs to be acknowledged in any movement for equal human rights and all movements in equal human rights. And we did see that in the 60s and 70s in the second wave feminist movement. That was started by middle-class white women who wanted to have jobs that they felt they were qualified for. And it didn't take very long for a lot of women from the working class to go, oh, we have jobs, and they're awful. Like, there are jobs that women can get. Just because you're middle-class and white, you don't want them. You know, so there are other bigger problems. And I really appreciate what you said about, how did you put it? I can't remember exactly how you put it, about intersectionality there. But like, we are not singular in our experiences. So yes, I'm a woman and I have faced discrimination because of that. And I'm also gay. And so I know that there are certain things. I mean, like up until recently, I wouldn't have been able to get married. So that's a new thing. But then on the other hand, because of being raised in a culture where whiteness is taught as valuable, and because I'm middle class, I also know what it's like to come from a place of privilege. So I have both experiences. And I think a lot of the time we end up with this separation because we think you're either oppressed or you're an oppressor, and that's it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that's not always the case. You can be part of multiple groups. One really good example to, you know, keep up with the Black Lives Matter thing would be when Colin Kaepernick started taking a knee, and a lot of people criticized him because he was rich. And so they're saying, you know, well, you're pale and you're rich, so even though you're technically an African American, you can't possibly understand the experience that, you know, a person living in a ghetto has. But that's not necessarily true. Like, I'm pretty sure Colin Kaepernick lives in a really nice neighborhood. There's probably police and security guards in that neighborhood that were confused by him being there before they realized he was a football star.
Yes.
Like, I know I personally, I live in a really nice neighborhood and have a bad car. And I get pulled over all the time. And it's just because, you know, it seems out of place. I'm sure that the police can't see the color of my skin when they pull me over. They just see my crappy car in a nice neighborhood. But there's always these assumptions about what belongs in different places. And it's very difficult, again, to judge what belongs somewhere, because that's usually based on what that thing is. Like, for Colin Kaepernick and living in a nice neighborhood, it's based on who he is. He is a rich person. But just from looking at him, because he doesn't look the way the other rich people look, it's assumed that he doesn't belong, just based on, you know, that one aspect of his identity.
That's the simplistic view that gets taken, you know, like when people say that there is no institutionalized racism within police services because there are Black police officers. It's like, well, it's also speaking to the fact that a person can belong to a group and also discriminate against that group. Like, I have met some women who are incredibly misogynistic and who exude toxic masculinity. It is a difficult one because there's sort of this default that, oh, well, if you belong to that group, then you couldn't possibly be influenced by the societal pressures of what you grew up around, right? And all of the media representations.
Yeah. I experience that personally all the time. And it's something I'm trying to work on. But I also have a middle class background. You know, both my parents are university educated. There's a whole bunch of books on the shelf next to me right now. And if I'm out in public and I see a Black person that's portraying what I might consider to be like a thug image, you know, they're dressed in like a hip hop style of clothing, or they're speaking in a certain way that I would associate with like bad rap videos, then I discriminate against them. And it's not because I'm like, oh, look at you, you're a thug. it's because I'm saying, hey, man, by looking and acting the way that those people are expecting you to look and act, you're reinforcing the idea in those people's minds that I'm like that too. So you're making it more difficult for me. And I think that kind of racism is almost more detrimental when it's coming in from the inside of that group, as opposed to from the outside of the group. It's even more harmful, because that's me saying that you as a black person can't be whoever you want to be. Yeah, you have to not be what white people expect you to be.
Okay, so I'm going to throw this out there just to see. Have you watched any Luke Cage?
Oh, I love it.
Oh, okay. See, now here's the question, because I, in my social circle, have an awful lot of white friends, and we've had conversations about whether or not it's blaxploitation, and none of us are experts on it, and I'm not of a generation where I was exposed to blaxploitation, but my understanding of blaxploitation was really that it was black films targeted at black audiences by white filmmakers who were making money off of that, but also in conjunction with a lot of stereotypes. So I would love to hear your take on Luke Cage, because personally I just love it because Luke Cage, I mean, a bulletproof black man in a hoodie. I mean, that is such a statement.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that episode blew my mind. It blew my mind. And actually, that's a really good starting point, because I was watching that episode, you know, where he, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen it.
You can spoiler away. I'll get to it eventually.
Okay. So yeah, he's running away from the police and he's got a hoodie full of bullet holes. And while he's running away, he sees the stores being robbed and he's like, really, guys, like, do I have to stop a robbery right now? I'm kind of busy. But goes in and does it. And there's a famous rapper. I think it might have been Method Man. I'm not sure. I shouldn't say any names. Anyway, there's a rapper in there who sees him and he's like, he has a fanboy moment because, you know, it's Luke Cage, the bulletproof guy.
Right.
And Luke Cage has a fanboy moment because it's this hip hop star and they trade hoodies. And what starts happening is people find out that, you know, this hero in their community is running away from the police and he's wearing a hoodie full of bullet holes. And everybody in the neighborhood starts wearing hoodies full of bullet holes. So the police can't tell which big black guy is Luke Cage and which one's just someone walking down the street. And it was the most amazing thing for me to see that, you know, like a community rallying around a hero who was one of their own. And I was watching that episode and I turned to a friend of mine who's also into superhero things. And I was like, is the way that I feel when I see Luke Cage on the screen the way that you feel when you see Captain America or Batman or Spider-Man or any of those superheroes who look like you? Because it resonated with me in a way that like other superhero films never had before. And it's because this was a hero who was a hero for me.
That is powerful. That is how I felt about the newest Ghostbusters. It was mind-blowing to sit there and watch a film where it was all women and to realize that I'm not used to that. And that was actually very shortly after seeing Star Wars as well. And like both of those and Zootopia. I don't know if you've seen Zootopia.
No, but it's been highly recommended.
Yeah, it's basically Disney Animal Farm. It's definitely about race and it's definitely about gender. It's pretty phenomenal. But all three were films where I was like, wow, strong, independent female leads. My mind is blown because I'm so not used to this. And it's also awesome. I didn't realize what I was missing.
Yeah, totally. It was eye-opening, like such an amazing experience to have a hero that is what I see when I look in the mirror. And as I assume it was with you, like you just said, like you hadn't realized how profound of a thing that is until it actually happened. And I can't help but wonder, are we really missing out on so profound of an experience that, you know, that like third of the planet that this is all made for doesn't even notice it's happening because they have it every day with everything?
Besides seeing something, like actually having a representation on the screen that you can identify with, what are other aspects of that show that you find really empowering?
Well, one thing was the characters represent, I guess you could say, different kinds of black. There is not a monolithic experience within any subcultural group. And being African American in the United States is often considered to be a monolithic experience, mm-hmm. but it really isn't. And from the first scene in the barbershop, there's Pop, who used to be a gangster, but has now gone straight, and nobody's allowed to swear while they're in the shop. But sometimes he curses. There's Luke Cage, who doesn't curse at all for any reason. You know, he enunciates. And then the two guys playing chess, you know, one of them is an intellectual, and the other one is totally like a back alley gangster, but they're both intelligent enough to compete with each other at chess. There was no determination made about their value as a person based on what their job was or the way that they spoke was.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was considered to be stupid because they were a gangster or smart because they weren't. And to see that all of the characters, even the villains, were motivated by trying to benefit their community. Like, you know, Luke Cage is trying to get rid of crime because people in his neighborhood are dying. The gangster club owner, you know, wants
Cottonmouth.
Cottonmouth, thank you. Wants to like build a legacy and improve the quality of life for everybody in his neighborhood. He's just going about it a different way. And same with his sister. You know, she's like treading the line between both worlds, trying to get legitimate things done for the people and using illegitimate tools to do it. Every one of those characters is just using what they have available to them to do what they think is best. And I thought that was really neat, that there was nobody who was actually motivated by just wanting to take and hurt people.
They all have their own vision for Harlem.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the use of the N-word throughout and showing the difference between people who choose to identify with it and those who don't. Because I think that's another interesting commentary, like talking about reclaiming words and being really powerful with that. And like some people really enjoy it. Like when I was younger, I was not reticent to use the word dyke, but I was very aware that around women of a certain age, I probably shouldn't, because for them, their experience was that it was always used really hatefully. And now that I'm older, it's still not a word that personally I find uncomfortable, but I've kind of moved on from that idea of seeing it as something to reclaim. But I also wouldn't necessarily criticize anyone for using it unless I thought that they hadn't necessarily thought about it. So I find that really interesting in watching it, because somebody will say, don't call me that, or yeah. I am not that kind of black person.
Yes. That's a big debate within black community in North America in general. For my family, we would never call each other that. But if I'm hanging out with my cousins, I might call my cousins that. A lot of it is the way it's used. Like, for example, when Cottonmouth, he would use it in a variety of ways. I don't know what your audience is like. Is it okay if I use the word?
It's fine for you to use the word. I'll make sure there's a content notification on this one.
Okay. All right. So in one scene, one of his guys does something really good and he says, "My nigga,"
right.
You know, and it was like appreciative. He was like, "Yes, you are close enough to me that I'm going to call you one of my people." And then in other scenes where he's angry about someone and he says like, you know, "You fucking nigger." And that's totally different. That's like, you are a lesser form of this thing that we are. You're not one of my people. And so there's a lot of discussion about context and are we really reclaiming it if we still use it as an insult,
right,
alongside using it as a term of endearment. And there's also a large thought among black people who don't use that word that there are different kinds of black people, that there are Negroes and there are niggers. And, you know, the former are people who take responsibility for their actions. And the latter are people who blame the system and they blame everybody else. And that's a belief that I've really struggled with, because I think, you know, the system is partially to blame, as much as I do have to take personal responsibility. So I don't think it can be used to describe different kinds of black people. But there are a lot of people who don't share my opinion on that matter.
There isn't a straight answer. There isn't a, this is the right way. Like you said, it's so complex, right? There's so much more involved in it, from seeing how it's used, is, again, it really does speak to class to a certain extent.
Yes.
And possibly also where somebody is from originally. So it is a very complex thing. I know that, for example, the word bitch can be used as a term of affection, and some people really like that, and it actually is. That's that same sort of thing, right? Like, you say, like, oh yeah, she's my bitch, and it's like, it means you're really good friends, and some women will speak to each other that way. I would find that really weird. Yeah. But I wouldn't want to, I never want to represent all women ever, everywhere. Like, I find that very annoying if you end up becoming the one person that people go to as the expert. Hopefully I haven't done that with you regarding Luke Cage. I am accepting that this is just your opinion on it, but it's a helpful opinion from a perspective that I haven't heard yet. So I'm hoping that it will then be a helpful perspective for other people as well. I mean, we've covered a lot of ground here. With regards to your approach of deep thinking, remembering that you are part of something much bigger than just you, and that even you in yourself are hard to define, what are the tools or resources or books you've read, people you listen to, that you would recommend that people go to?
Wow, that's a big question.
It is a big question, I know.
Well, a lot of my understanding wouldn't have been possible without reading the ideas of all the great people who came before me and having them in context. I would recommend that a good starting place would be, like, take some philosophy courses in university, you know, read Aristotle and Plato and the Greeks, and work your way up to the Enlightenment. And you can see how it is that our understanding of our place in the world has changed as each of these people take the ideas of the ones before them and fold them in with what the current understanding of the world is. For me, doing that stuff was a template for how I could come up with my own ideas about how things work. Something really profound for me recently has actually been reading historical fantasy. Not fluff historical fantasy, but historical fantasy that's written by historians and archaeologists, because it gives another story for something that I've already learned about factually. Like, there's this book that I just finished reading. It's about Hernando de Soto's invasion of Florida, and it's all written from the perspective of a merchant in one of the indigenous tribes. And so, you know, he's like watching this army come, and they talk about how, like, they don't understand. He approaches under the power of trade and does, like, all the ritual offerings that you're supposed to do to appease the divine, and then just gets enslaved. And right. It makes no sense to them that these people are acting this way, because the way that they act doesn't match up with anything that they understand. And then from the perspective of the Europeans, this dude covered himself in white and red paint and walked towards us playing a flute and swinging around a stick covered in feathers. Like, what the hell is he doing? This makes no sense. But he looks strong. Let's get him to carry our bags. From, like, you know, a historical perspective, understanding the names and the dates and, you know, how many deaths in which village and all that, I never had a story for what any of those events meant to the people who were involved in them. And by linking what you know factually with a story, it makes you look at it a little bit differently and maybe question some of the assumptions that you've already made. And I would say that would be the next biggest tool, is questioning. If I care enough to have an opinion about something, then I believe that I care enough to question my opinion and verify whether or not what I believe is true.
That's really good. I think that there's a lot to be said for not knowing. I do spend a lot of time when I, especially if I find that I'm threatened by someone else questioning my own opinion. I think that's always a really good sign that I should go and question that opinion myself. If I'm really confident in that opinion and I've genuinely tested it out and thought it through, I shouldn't feel threatened.
Exactly. Cool. Yeah, that was something one of my professors said in school. If any time someone asks you a question, your initial response is panic, fear, or anger, then you probably haven't thought about it enough to give them a good answer. Like, unless I know exactly what it is that I'm going to say in response to this, I'm not ready to respond to it in a substantive manner. One thing that that I've been doing that's helping me a lot with questioning my own assumptions especially with this election right now, asking questions of people who support Donald Trump, it's really easy to read their response and just pass it off as being, you know, racist, xenophobic, misogynistic, whatever form of prejudice or discrimination it happens to fall into. But anytime I respond in that manner, essentially what I'm doing is I'm threatening their identity, like what we said earlier. And so I'm not going to learn anything from someone who feels threatened. And if I ask them questions and it seems, you know, I might imply that I agree with them without saying I agree with them, to open them up to expressing themselves. But then once I get their opinion, I can look at whether or not that's something that I considered. And, you know, maybe I might be wrong in thinking that they're racist, sexist, or whatever. And that's an opportunity I wouldn't have had if I had just labeled them and attacked them right off the bat.
In labeling people and attacking them has never worked for anyone ever in the history of anything.
Yeah, not at all. And I actually, I had an interaction with someone on the internet the other day who was being very racist and misogynistic. And I had to step into his defense by explaining to my friends that calling him a racist is just as threatening to his worldview and identity as him calling them whatever racist name he was calling them. We tend to think, especially on the social justice side of things, that calling someone out for disagreeable behaviors is always the best way to address those things. But the best way for someone to learn anything is to learn it themselves, not to be told. Mm-hmm. And only allow people to teach themselves by asking them questions. Anytime you're telling somebody something, they're questioning you instead of questioning themselves. And you're not going to make any progress with someone who feels threatened. And I really do think that we forget that, you know, calling someone racist or sexist or xenophobic is just as much a threat to their identity as being referred to or treated racist or sexist is to those of us who get treated that way.
Yeah, versus, and it is, I mean, it's about the approach as well, right? There's a difference between saying you're racist and that was racist.
Totally.
And being really clear about that, because you can say that was racist and people will hear it as you're racist, unless you're in the right safe space to do that. And safe doesn't necessarily mean comfortable.
Yes, definitely. That's a big thing that we dealt with when I was in university, too, is safe spaces versus comfortable spaces. There's a lot of things that we need to talk about that aren't comfortable. In fact, a lot of the most important things that we need to talk about are uncomfortable things to talk about. But we have to talk about them. And being uncomfortable is absolutely necessary for growth in any sense.
I'd like to thank Chris for taking the time to chat with me, and to thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this or any other episode, please help promote this podcast by sharing it through social media. You can find out more about the various things that I get up to through my website, where you can also sign up to get my monthly wrap-up email. Thank you to Dexter Britton for composing the fantastic music accompanying this and the previous two seasons of Everything is Workable. I'll be back next week with another fantastic interview for you.